Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Michael Vann of Sacramento State University, but you can call me Mike. Today I'll be talking with Matt Chrisman about his co-authored book, The Chapo Guide to Revolution, a manifesto against logic, facts, and reason, co-authored with Felix Biederman, Virgil Texas, Will Menaker, and Brendan James. It was illustrated by Eli Valley and John White and published with Simon & Schuster in 2018. Matt Chrisman is one of the co-hosts of Chapo Trap House, a hugely popular and rather influential podcast. The Chapo crew includes the above authors, although the traitorous Brendan James was purged for some sort of Stalinist removal and evidently replaced with Amber A. Lee Frost in the past few years. For the uninitiated, Chapo Trap House is a comedic political podcast that has been branded as the Dirtbag Left. If you haven't listened, check it out. With a solid dose of scatological humor, it's not for everyone, but I think most of these listeners will find it to be some of the smartest political and cultural criticism around right now. Mr. Chrisman has appeared in a number of related podcasts and regularly hosts a stream where he takes questions and basically rants about stuff ranging from the politics of the American Civil War to the spiritual side of hallucinogens. On the Chapo podcast and in these streams, he displays an impressive command of history and frequently grounds his analysis in historical context. So as a historian, it's something I always appreciate. He also put out a few special episodes of Chapo Trap House called The Inebriated Historian, the best of which offered a very informed and insightful discussion of fascism. And there was also a wonderful episode on sewer socialism in the upper Midwest. The Chapo Guide to Revolution is a satirical work, but much of it is grounded in historical research. Glenn Greenwald said of it, this book is intellectually serious and analytically original, as it is irreverent and funny. It deserves widespread readership, substantial discussion, and all the gushing and angry reactions it will inevitably provoke. Tim Heidecker called it Howard Zinn on acid or some shit like that, which I think is maybe the most amazing book blurb ever. Matt Chrisman, welcome to New Books in History.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So before we get into the book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you attended Carroll College in Wisconsin. Did you major in history?
Yeah, I was a double major in history and English writing.
So what drew you to history as a young Matt Chrisman?
I was a essentially a weeb for the Civil War. Like other people were enjoying Star Wars or Pokemons, and it was the Civil War. And that fixation sort of expanded to be more broad than just that era. But that was, it structured my relationship, I guess, to academia and my interests. That's what led me to pursue it.
Yeah. I mean, what about the Civil War? I mean, was this as a teenager?
A very young kid. The military stuff is usually what gets like a young guy historically interested in the Civil War. But I guess it was just something about the drama of it and all that. But over time, it became more involved than just caring about which regiment was where or whatever. But that's certainly how it started.
Yeah. Yeah. And then how did your historical thinking evolve since then? I mean,
I don't care about battles as much as I used to, that's for sure. I don't fixate on the minutiae of military history the way that I did. And it does seem like that is often an entry point for people. But at some point you recognize the limitations of that, or you decide, actually, this is the stuff I really do care about. I eventually found that it wasn't able to sustain my interest.
Yeah. I mean, when did you sort of make that transition from thinking about history as sort of the minutiae and the stuff to history as a more analytical project?
It was college. It was the experience of, actually trying to academically study the subject as opposed to just read about it. Yeah. And that made me, just the challenge of having to, rather than explain something that happened or reconstruct a narrative, to step back and offer some sort of attempt to understand why it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you do with history since college.
I mean, before. Not much. I was a failed grad student, essentially. I went to grad school for history, but.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. But and I was pretty disenchanted with it after the first year, but then I got a teaching assistantship for the second year, so I figured I'd just do that. And at the end of that, I realized, okay, this is not really the specific situation of the school I was in and what I was studying. I was not finding a reason to be it. So I left, and I didn't do much with it, honestly. I kind of wandered around. But now I'm getting a chance to come back to it, which I'm appreciating.
Yeah. All of us who've been in graduate school at one point or another, understand that horror of the first couple of years. And, not sure why I plugged along. I kind of felt like Richard Gere at an Officer and a Gentleman. You were, I've got nowhere else to go.
Well, I mean, that's certainly why I went to grad school in the first place.
Yeah.
But I think when I was there, I realized that, I would have needed a different combination of subject and essentially I could not keep doing it just because I didn't know why I was doing it. And I just stopped instead of really interrogating it. And that was sort of a pattern for a long time with me.
Yeah. And professionally, it's probably the dumbest thing you could do. Pursue a doctorate in the humanities. And the job market just...
Yeah.
I probably really shouldn't go there, but it is. a contradiction of late capitalism that we are producing so many PhDs in the humanities and are not supplying viable career opportunities for all of them. But we don't need to go there. What did you want to focus on then in terms of subject?
I was an Americanist, but I mean, partially just because I'm terrible at foreign languages and just, it was always a non-starter that I was ever going to do any academic work that involved translating things. So I was sort of stuck with, England or the United States and with that Civil War grounding, America stuck with me. But as I studied America, my time interest sort of shifted forward from the Civil War toward to the 20th century. Now I would say that I'm most interested when I examine American history, recently anyway, I've been in like the post-war era, although now I'm drifting back to the Civil War again from the other side after having all, these other thoughts and projects. Now I'm thinking of coming back to the Civil War era anyway as something to study more rigorously.
Yeah, my wife's a big fan of your stream and said that you've actually been talking a lot about Reconstruction lately, and
yeah,
together like a Reconstruction book club or something, or a reading group.
Yeah, well, I want to do a Reconstruction book club with the stream as part of a broader project that I'm hoping will come together next year, where I do something where I was inspired by a book by Phil Cunliffe about that came out in 2000 for Zero Books in 2017 called Lenin Lives, mm-hmm. which was essentially what if the Soviet project had, more than anything, what if it had linked up with the German revolutionary project in post-war World War One, I'm a huge alt history fan. I've read way too many Harry Turtledove novels, for example, and. Right now, I think the interesting academic element of it, or at least intellectual element of that sort of project, is injecting contingency into history in a way that is not wish fulfillment or moral judgment, which seems to be about like what most people, what the project of history seems to be now, looking at the past to pick the good guys and the bad guys and things like that. What I really want to do is look back and ask the question seriously. And the thing is, I don't really know the answer. How different would things have been in America if Lincoln had not been assassinated? Because one of the things about being a Marxist historian is that you, or a mixed historical, using Marxist historical analysis of all, is that you end up finding at every point while analyzing the history, you end up fixating on, as you should, the structural predeterminators of behavior or of outcome. But there is this matrix always where material relationships and trends created by them intersect with the random realities of life. And for the most part, that the randomness is eventually just overdetermined enough that no individual event can be said to have had some alternative timeline hiding within it, because something else would have come along to prevent that from happening. And I suspect, and I'm hoping to tease out whether to what degree I'm right, by going back and really doing a thorough look at the scholarship on just what could have been different, and if it was, why it would have been, and essentially to say, what were the other things happening? What were the other trends that were eventually sort of defeated, extinguished, co-opted, subverted in the process of America abandoning Reconstruction and embracing industrial capitalism the way it did?
Yeah, I mean, it's this massive what-if moment in American history. And
And I think there aren't that many of them, because we look back at stuff like, what if this had happened? What, like, people talk about the Kennedy assassination. People talk about the turn away from radicalism within the labor movement after World War II, Henry Wallace's VP status with relative to Roosevelt's health, and all of those to me just seem like whatever change would have been resulted by a different outcome would have been neutralized by every other strain, every other overdetermining factor within American history.
Yeah, there's like certain parameters sort of channeling
exactly actions,
but with Reconstruction, it's like a whole paradigm shift, right?
Exactly. We had this situation where the constitutional order had been destroyed, and half the country was under military occupation with a fully unified or largely unified, northern investment in the political project. And what that political project was, I think, is potentially could have been significantly different. And it's sort of a, for want of a nails type method, start from the presumption, instead of having essentially the worst person on earth to be president during the beginning of Reconstruction, what if it's a guy who over the past 4 years had proven that in the specific crisis of the Civil War, to have been almost uniquely qualified to be there, had kept being there.
Yeah. No, I find that period really fascinating. So I my work is on Southeast Asia and a little bit on North Africa with the French colonial empire. And I'm doing work on Cold War and images of mass violence and genocide. And I didn't study much American history in high school. I'm from Hawaii, where the Civil War is like the most exotic thing ever. Didn't learn much about Reconstruction for some reason. Didn't learn much about that as a graduate student. And then a few years ago, found myself teaching in China at a university in Shanghai in the summer, and got assigned an American history class, which I know nothing about. Mm-hmm. And reading the sections on Reconstruction, I was like, oh my God, why didn't anybody tell me about this? I mean, it's such this incredible moment where, just the stats on how many Black legislators there are in the 1870s that we don't see again till what, the 1970s?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Just so many moments for, again, this radical, radical paradigm shift. In terms of historiography, what historians influence you, and what sort of schools of history are you drawn to?
Obviously, I like the Marx. I don't know. It's interesting. I think of myself, as a Marxist in my approach to history specifically. But at the same time, I really enjoy popular history too, mm-hmm. And also in like non-Marxist material history. I'm a big fan of the world system stuff, like Wallenstein. The book Escape from Rome by Walter Scheidel that came out a couple of years ago. I was hugely impressed by. But in terms of Civil War stuff, Fanner, obviously, Du Bois. And if you're the book that just kind of started it all for me, honestly, in terms of providing a baseline to build from was McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom.
Yeah, well, I know nothing about the Civil War stuff. but you get me excited when you talk about world systems. André Gundefranck, is he in your list of guys?
You got to love your Gundefranck. Yeah. Give me that Gundefranck.
He drives my graduate students crazy. And they point out that he argues with himself in the footnotes. And of all the books I assign in my graduate seminars, it definitely has the most exclamation points.
Well, you should always be arguing with the past version of yourself at all times. So I support that. Yeah.
I know you're a big fan of Marx's 18th Brumaire. Why is that text important to you, and what value do you find in it?
The main thing I get from it is that as someone who approaches, political questions first from the historic grounding, that's where I got my first interest in sort of understanding, how human society works and things like that. It was from history rather than from economics or philosophy or anything like that. Is that while I obviously love all of Marx's like most theoretical works, there is something uniquely enjoyable about reading his historical stuff, and the Brumaire is his most enjoyable, just as like a prose as a piece of prose, and also as a representation of how historical analysis, in this case, very recent history, obviously, but how narrative analysis of an event can be used to generate broader insights that can be applied more generally. And yeah. I think that for a lot of people like me who might struggle with a sort of disembodied conceptual approaches to political economy, that a grounded historical one can be a great opening. I mean, you wouldn't want to end there, but it's a great way to introduce someone to those ideas.
Yeah. What specific lessons are from that text? I mean,
well, the one thing
in terms of the thinking.
One thing I really love in that book, and that is useful, and this is not necessarily even theoretical as much as it is broadly as political, is that is the focus in that book on the conflict within bourgeois rule, and because I think that is a element that gets elided when you are thinking in terms of broad notions of a like Dujac class dictatorship as the model of the state, and like that's true and accurate, but if that is just sort of a broad idea that is not interrogated, it ends up allowing you to lose valuable understanding of how what we think of as political outcomes are generated not by necessarily a conflict between two classes, but a conflict within the broader ruling class because of the competing systems of profit that they orient around, and that those conflicts have to be subsumed somehow, and the process by where Bonaparte, Napoleon III, subsumes all the conflicts within the broader French bourgeois, and then ascends over them against the will of any group of the bourgeois themselves, is important, and especially important to understand the current moment in American politics, because I like the so many questions about for example, the specific
meaning of Trump as a political phenomenon can really only be understood in the context of inter-class rule conflict, not as like a broader political issue.
You know, I know that you've made some comments about the 18th premier being useful for understanding Trumpism, but also not being useful sometimes and like sort of being misinterpreted. What are some of the bad takes on history that you've seen or maybe particularly irk you?
I would say that the main thing that irks me, not even a specific take, is a general attitude towards history is the search for the good guys and the bad guys. And I fully understand why that happens. And it's a way, and especially if people want to use history as a jumping off point to discuss with other people, those sort of questions are assured to evoke a response because people have strong feelings on these. But and it's not to say that there aren't bad good people in history, obviously there certainly are, but that the focus on that as the sum of understanding history ends up alighting and obscuring all of the forces that constrain and in many cases predetermine the decisions that political figures and the historical figures make. And that a lot of people resist that insight because they think it lets them off the hook or something, or lets off the people who have benefited now from crimes of the past off the hook. And I really don't think that's only the case if you're not doing anything other, than trying to see who the good and the bad people are. History matters because it helps you understand the present. Otherwise it's just stories that you like reading about. And so if you can cleanse yourself of a need to judge, and that helps you find and identify the material grounding and the material predetermining for outcomes in the past, it can help you see it more around you in the moment.
Yeah, no, I really feel you on that, pushing back on that good guys and bad guys search. And now I realize how much that colored my education. I was born in 67, high school in the early 80s and undergraduate in the late 80s. And, so much of the discussion of Cold War mm-hmm. was good guys and bad guys and just destroyed all levels of nuance. Mm-hmm. And arguing for there was pretty good healthcare in the Soviet Union, and doctors were plentiful, and there was childcare. That was just like anathema. You couldn't say that.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side, as I got into graduate school, and I was at UC Santa Cruz, when Angela Davis was on faculty, and my advisor was former Maoist, and got this, I'm studying imperialism, and I get this. This very radical critique of this history I've been studying previously. And unfortunately, a lot of that nationalist global South narrative of imperialism is about good guys and bad guys once again.
Yep.
And, it's just, okay, it's the bad guys are the white folks now, hooray. But now the field is getting beyond that, but it really is, it is a detriment to the development of sophisticated thinking and just nuance.
Exactly. And specifically with the colonial stuff, I'm sorry, but if the white people are just the bad guys, and they also have to this moment control of the levers of the world economic system, and their badness is some sort of permanent creates some sort of permanent barrier between the people who make up broadly the white beneficiaries of empire and everybody else, then there's no reason to believe that the future will be anything else than the further complete annihilation of the biome and the just frantic piling up of surplus on behalf of these exploiters, because they're the bad guys. What else do you expect them to do?
Right. I could just throw random history questions at you all day, but let's talk about the book for a little bit. what were you trying to do with this this book, this Chapo Guide to Revolution? I mean, why did you guys write this book?
I think it's because our show blew up very quickly in this lead up to the 2016 election, and then Trump won, to everyone's shock.
The live cast of you guys when Trump won is that's must see TV.
Absolutely.
I don't know, maybe it was Will or you, but made the comment about, well, this destroys our business model. We were gonna spend 4 years owning Hillary, and now we have the Trump can be the death of comedy in so many ways, because it's I mean, this is a cliche that's been belabored, but go on.
And we had this, new audience, and we felt like it would be good for us to be able to get something out that would have more, and be more thought out, perhaps more rigorous, more, and more easily understandable than like the relatively loose and largely contextual nature of like a podcast.
And the understandable, I think, is something really admirable about what you guys bring, and making a lot of complex ideas accessible, mm-hmm. both with plain speak, but also with humor, and getting people to, stick along for the potty humor. There's some good, there's some medicine coming in with that honey or sugar, whatever the hell Mary Poppins said. I don't know my English history, but, what's the point of the book? There's the famous review, right? Where somebody called it the dumbest book on socialism they ever read.
Oh yeah. But Bill Scheer, shout out.
Yeah. Yeah. friend of the pod. Right. Like the work of Marx, which isn't really about socialism or communism. Marx is writing about capitalism, right? Marx is writing about history. He's got very little to say about what things will look like after the revolution. I mean, just a few lines here and there. Yeah. Your book, without, spoiler alert, I mean, it is in the same way as it's a Marxist critique in the sense of like what Marx talks about, not necessarily methodologically, but it's a critique of all this crap that we've been going through for, the past few years, and then its longer historical roots. And at the very, very end, there's a couple of very like lovely, heartfelt pages of imagining a better future. But like Marx, it's just sort of, that's out there, but here's the critique of what's going on right now. Am I reading that right?
Yeah. 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 We're taking that idea of just trying to take, like, we wanted to take, the experience of living, for a young person or specifically a young person who listens to our show already, that demographic and the world as they understand it and slice it into like broad tranches and then sort of put them under a microscope.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, let's look at some of those tranches. There's a chapter on liberalism, on the libs. Again, very much grounded in history. You do this for both the libs and the conservatives. What are the sort of the key moments in the historical development of liberalism for you?
Well, I'd say like the one we live in, I don't know if we really got, I mean, I, my thinking has developed a lot since we wrote the book on a lot of things. So I don't think if I, rewrote it again, it would be the same book, certainly. But I think what we were trying to get across in that book, in that section, is the nature of liberalism is less about any kind of a triumph over time over oppression or like even a taming of capitalism, so much as the ever expanding creation of sort of a cultural superstructure around capitalism to validate it. To give it a buy-in, essentially, psychically, to the maximum number of people, and that in doing so, it creates these sort of castes of mandarins within the different technocratic realms of control, both politically and media wise, and that the election of Trump really sent a lot of them into a deep existential horror, because Trump was exactly what all of those things exist to prevent happening.
Yeah. But like historically, are there any sort of important moments in this narrative? I mean,
obviously it all, it starts with the Constitution and specifically the way we remember the Constitution. We remember the process of the founding fathers coming together to forge a nation, and the fetishization of procedure that came out of that, regardless of the outcome of that procedure.
Right. But of course, the Sorkin aspect of American history.
But I'd say that if we want to trace the roots of liberalism as a hegemonic idea now, the real starting point is the progressive movement of the late 1800s, early 1900s. And I'd say brought into its fullest articulation by the presidency of Woodrow Wilson. That's things like the income tax and the creation of the Federal Reserve, and of course during World War I and the Alien Sedition Acts, or Espionage Acts. It was a package of reforms designed to not subordinate capitalism, but essentially coordinate capitalism to maintain stability in a way that the individual actors within capitalism, specifically the individual capitalists, were unable to do themselves because of the fact that they are all in competition with one another.
Yeah. What, on the flip side, for the conservative movement, you do a great job showing the historical development and the frustrations of conservatives over the course of most of the 20th century, and then their rise and starting with the 80s. What are the key points there?
I mean, it starts with, honestly, I think American conservatism is essentially the activization of the lizard brain American conception of freedom, which is the idea that there is such a thing as of an ungoverned life, but that a person can be, in a sense, independent of a social structure and still benefit from social goods, which was only ever viable even as an intellectual concept because of the specific nature of American development and the massive amount of land that was always available to be expropriated.
Settler colonialism and settler genocide.
Exactly.
Constantly,
yes.
Feeding that, right?
And that it's essentially the American id, which is at times being battling and being constrained by the superego of liberalism. And its modern manifestation comes as a reactionary response to the New Deal. The same way that the first reactionary movement in modern European history happened after the French Revolution. And Rick Perlstein's books on the rise of the conservative movement and its taking over the Republican Party from Goldwater to Reagan, I think, are some of the best at tracking that trajectory. And that era specifically is, I think, the crucial proving ground that would eventually create a more and more powerful and extreme political tendency.
Do you think that compared to liberalism, that the conservative movement has a much more grounded material objectives, whereas liberalism just become, at least in the past few years, really about culture and identity debates?
Well, the thing is that they're both. Both liberalism and conservatism are, as political projects, they kind of have to end up being about culture. Conservatism is now, Trumpism is all just cultural grievance. There is no, any, all the gestures towards any real material critique of globalism or American capitalism are as vestigial, honestly, as any of the critiques of the 1% or corporations that come from Democrats and from liberals more broadly. The thing that animates voters on both sides and the politicians, at least in their rhetoric, is is this continued sustained cultural conflict, because the actual material economic project is bipartisan and operates without any adjudication by the either party or their voters. Because as long as you only have two parties, and as long as the question of the broader economic destiny of the country is not up for debate, which it hasn't been in this country since the 70s, then all we can have is cultural conflict.
Yeah. How about the American empire? What, how do you see the American empire as operating in history and, comparisons with other empires? I was listening to, I think, maybe it was Trash Future, recently. And they were talking about, Amazon and, comparing it to the East India Company, which was, I thought a thoughtful point.
Yeah.
Let's go 200 years in the future and we're historians. How do we go back and sort of contextualize the history of the American empire and make comparisons?
I think that what Fred said about the East India Company is very indicative of the proper approach, which is to understand the American empire as not an American empire, but as the continuation of a broader capitalist project that started in the Netherlands and then the United Kingdom in the 17th and 18th century. We took the baton basically from them after World War II, and that the American empire has been a mechanism for ensuring that that the resources of the world broadly will be priced at a way that ensures that the inheritors of that empire in the United States and the West more broadly are the consumers of surplus. And the people who actually live where resources are will always be the the exploited sources of surplus, either materially or in the form of labor, that are then exploited.
And then it's globalized, right? And then
yes,
these things are beyond the horizon, and it makes it much easier to hide some of these contradictions and these most grievous aspects of labor and resource exploitation.
Yes. It's a unit, and that really, like, the political conflict we see in America, such that it actually exists at the level of things like, you know, globalization and protectionism between the parties, is basically one of those intra-bourgeois civil wars between the Republicans broadly, the lumpen billionaire class of restrained, geographically fixed capitalism in America, like petroleum and natural gas extraction. Retail and things like that, opposed to the Democrats, who are more broadly influenced by transnational capital, like finance capital, which, I mean, broadly they're on the same side, but there is a conflict of interest between them. And more importantly, there is a conflict of understanding of how this system works. And one of the big ones is, one of the big drivers is a fundamental misapprehension on the part of, you know, the lumpen reactionary conservative bourgeois, that there is such a thing as American capitalism, that there is such a thing as the American economy that could be disaggregated from the global flow of capital. Well, crucially, this is the important thing, that could happen and that they could stay on top of that system. That they could continue their role as rentiers if the United States was somehow fundamentally removed from the influence of global capital flows.
Well, it's a bizarre, like, it's a bizarre sort of ill understood rehabilitation of mercantilist thinking, right?
Yeah.
That the Trump attacks on China and some of the things I hear people saying, I mean, it just makes absolutely no sense. We're not, economic competitors. I mean, we're the same systems. I mean, how would?
But none of our politics actually operates off of that assumption. Nobody will say that even like but, in but politics.
It's the undeniable material reality, right?
Sure, but like we don't live in that. In America, you don't have to live in a material reality. That's what all that surplus pays for. All that surplus pays for your ability to live in as far removed from material reality as possible, which more and more people are doing one way or the other.
So Trump can tweet out things about Chinese trade on his phone in Sebald in China and not have to think about it.
Yeah.
A little bit about the book, the writing of the book. How'd you guys do this? I mean, five of you put this book together? Did you have certain tasks? I mean, you on the show, you sort of play the role of the historian. I mean, did you guys divide this up? Did you do the historical research or?
Yeah. Well, it was sort of. It was essentially, it was divided by who wanted to write about what. And then the way that we generated it is largely through group discussions. We would get together and say, okay, we're talking about this. What do we want to say about it? And then we would kind of talk it out the way we do on the podcast. But then instead of just recording it and having people listen to it, we took those notes and then we would have specific members take that and then turn it into something more rounded out.
Yeah. And why do a satirical comedic book about these issues? I mean, this is your job.
Yeah.
Philosophically, like what does humor bring to this conversation?
I think it broadens the audience for the critique for one thing, because that has been the key to our success the entire time is that we make it more entertaining. And of course, at a certain level, even dry academic analysis of political economy is at this point in time for most Americans entertainment, because what practically are you going to do with it even after you get it? That's a question that nothing within our consumption can tell us. It has to come from within ourselves. And that's a challenge that is, you know, individual and very difficult. And it means that pretty much everything we're consuming, even at its most rigorous and serious, is fundamentally an entertainment product. And if that's the case, then it should probably be more rather than less entertaining. Mm-hmm. And humor helps. It makes people want to stick around for something that is not necessarily funny. And it helps contextualize things that might not be as easily understandable. It's as you said, it's the spoonful of sugar.
Yeah.
But also, just from all of us, we don't have any other way of talking about it. Like we are driven by background, by predilection, by the fact that we all found each other on Twitter doing jokes. That we have this desire to make people laugh. That is as fundamental to our will to power as our political convictions.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you have a sense of how you or the Chapo Project fit into sort of the history of comedy? Do you have a sense of what comedic traditions you see yourself a part of? I think a lot when I think about you guys, I think a lot of like various French provocateurs. I'm going to be pretentious there. Like, I mean, most recently being Charlie Hebdo, I mean, this, just throwing rocks at everything. But also, you know, 19th century, the work of Daumier, the French caricaturist with his caricatures of Louis Philippe as the pair, or Rabelais. I mean, Chapo has his very Rabelaisian moments, right? I mean, you would make him proud.
My co-host Amber wrote in her article that she wrote that coined the term dirtbag left, she referenced the French revolutionary pornographic cartoons as a historical antecedent.
I got to look that up because that makes me so happy. I published something in the Journal of World History about 2-3 years ago on pornographic cartoons in French colonial Hanoi. And how you can read white male culture of Hanoi that's not recorded in the archives through these cartoons. Mm-hmm. What do you know what that was in?
Believe it was the Baffler.
Okay, yeah. And so she coined the term dirtbag left.
She did, yes.
I was wondering about that. Like, how do you wear that? How do you feel about that term?
I feel like the term itself has sort of served its purpose. Essentially, especially after Trump won, there was an explosion of interest in socialism and leftism in the cultural sphere. And there's a lot of baggage to those concepts that left a lot of people in a position of anxiety between their desire to speak, their desire to consume media, and their desire to appear as, to themselves and others, as virtuous. And the conflict, and that left a lot of people wondering what to do, and there were different sort of paths to take, and one of the emergent ones was a 5-alarm critique of like the American culture broadly as inherently racist, misogynist, ist in every sense, and that's what Trump came from, and that needed to be fought, and that's not necessarily wrong. But in the context of a bunch of people trying to find their political identity online at the same time, the risk there is that those shibboleths and those expectations of behavior end up becoming alienating to some, and to those who enjoy them, cynical cudgels and ways to advance individual profile and authority within some emerging, subcultural space. And dirtbag left was a broad label, an easy to word descriptor to provide people who were kind of in that matrix with a brand essentially that they could coalesce around. But at this point, post Bernie, post now Biden, post Trump now almost, I feel like the necessity of that is reduced just because that moment has passed, and now we're much more broken up into tranches as consumers of media, and as such, I don't think we need to really have labels in order to guide people. I think people can kind of tell; people know where things are.
Hmm. What about some of the critiques of your guys' irony? This is irony laden work, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that some on the left have had a problem with that and interpreted it as nihilism. Some of the dangers of irony?
I don't know if there really are any, honestly. I feel like everybody got mad at irony is essentially mad at connotative meaning. And I think, mm-hmm. and it's not their fault. Like, fault is not, that's what I've been trying to do personally is, I've got a big hole to dig out of because Chapo is very judgmental inherently, because that's part of comedy is finding targets for ridicule, and you have to feel like you aren't a bad person for ridiculing someone, and the only way to do that is if they're a bad person. And the thing is, there are a lot of evil people in the world, but I think for a lot of people who appear very vexing in their wrong-headed critique of humor as a concept, a lot of it to me boils down to the fact that as we spend more and more of our lives mediated, and as our emotional lives are more and more mediated and translated into the sort of the ether of online spectacle, that the ability to get any meaning from a word, a sentence, a meme, or whatever that is not within the text itself becomes impossible, because what the way that irony is useful is the only way that it works is that the person using it and the person hearing it have a shared context for the word, so that beyond the plain meaning, the ironic meaning is legible. And information on the internet is stripped of context, mm-hmm. and everyone is coming to it completely separate from it. And for a lot of people, irony appears to be racism, appears to be reactionary, because the connotative meaning is invisible to them.
Yeah, that's spot on. are you optimistic? I mean, the book ends on an optimistic note, and I mean, where are we going?
I found that the best way to be optimistic is to realize how beside the point it is to either be optimistic or be pessimistic.
Yeah.
Because any broad social trend that we're talking about, like where we are going, is fundamentally beyond the power of any one of us to affect, beyond our just lives. But the question of what to do in our lives, the question of what to do every day that we're alive, every minute we're alive, the answer to that question, I think, can be found much closer to you than a abstract idea in your head about what the future is going to look like. And so the best way to be optimistic is to find a reason to live close to you. And everyone, I think, can find that, but they have to look. And one of the real dangers of online politics is it abstracts away from your life, your understanding of what you should be doing with it, because you feel the enormity of the horrors of the world are so vast that they have to be stopped, that you have a responsibility to stop them. And while we all have a responsibility to our fellow people and to ourselves to do, to seek out right and to help one another, that we can do that independently of whether things are going to be bad or good. We can do that no matter how things end up. And that's because we have no idea. None of us really know. And that should be liberating, or can be. And that, I think, is an alternative to either like an optimism that I think becomes brittle over time, or a pessimism that just becomes a soporific and a depression matrix.
Yeah. Again, those last couple of pages in the book, I thought were really, really, they really hit home to me. And I mean, the book is just like, you know, beating up on all these things I just hate so much, and seeing someone articulate them in the critique in a smart way with a good dose of humor. But like, as you know, I'm getting into 250 or 200 something pages into it, 250 pages into it. It's starting to grind me down, and I'm starting to go down that path of just sort of pessimistic and nihilistic thought. And then those last couple of pages, I mean, I thought they were really, really beautiful.
Thank you.
And it reminded me of some of the things I've heard you guys say during the primary campaign. There were a couple of live performances where you gave like these sort of from the heart appeals. And this was part of mobilizing the vote. I wish that many of the, especially on the left, critics of you guys' project would pay attention to those moments, because they really were, I think it really pulls the rug out from underneath that critique of, oh, it's just this ironic nihilism and potty humor.
Yeah, it's. I think the nihilism charge comes mostly from liberals. And I think what it boils down to is that our fundamental argument is that the system as such cannot generate anything other than misery and more misery over more time. And to a liberal who is devoted to the idea that the system is inviolable, the system is the questions of its being replaced have been shown by history to be beside the point. And starting from that premise, that hearing this system can only produce misery, it has to be nihilistic, because the system is all we have. And our insistence is that no, like, we actually do. Don't tell me how, because nobody knows how, but we have the capacity as people, as a species, to prevent that, to replace this system with one that is able to provide dignity for all, but not within the structures of the system itself. And the liberal identity is bound in the idea that no, my collaboration with all of the worst monstrosities of this system is morally validated by the fact that it is preferable to a more reactionary, more miserable version of this system that my interventions are preventing. And so, but to me and to the rest of Chapo, that is nihilism. That is the nihilistic view. That is the view that says doom is inevitable, because there is nothing any liberal has ever said. There is no project. There is no critique, and certainly no history that says that within the liberal tradition is any hope of human emancipation. And without that, without that like kindling at the heart of your politics, you are functionally, even if you're not aware of it, a nihilist. Mm. Look at Neil Cadlin. Look at Mr. Resistance, Obama's solicitor general, going before the Supreme Court to argue that that child slaves should not be able to sue corporations that purchase the result of their labor. And the response to any moral condemnation of that is someone's got to do it. And we say, no, they don't have to do it. And you sure as hell don't have to do it. And if you are doing it, it's because you are benefiting from this system.
Yeah. Yeah. You've been really generous with your time, and I've got just a couple more questions, but we talked a lot about American history. Any aspects of sort of international history that you find really, really important and useful lessons? You had Vincent Bevins on a couple of months ago. I interviewed him too, and his book on the Jakarta Method is just so...
It's great.
So great. And it was so... I mean, my highest compliment to that I can make about that book is I just seethe with jealousy that he wrote it. Nah. I spent 30 years studying Indonesia. He was there for 3 years and wrote a fantastic book. Damn him. But, you know, such is the Fourth Estate. Yeah. What, you know, you guys talk about Operation Gladio a lot. I mean, maybe that's just Felix and his, his gamer brain mentality.
Well, the thing is that Felix hates NATO with a furious passion, and Gladio was an explicit NATO project. So for him, it's too much to ignore. He has to come back to it. But yeah, broadly, the history of the Cold War is something I find very interesting, and I try to read as much about it enough. And one of the things that I think Jakarta Method is really good about doing is recontextualizing the Cold War away from our understanding of it as an ideological contest and towards a resource battle. And that is what the Cold War, which, I mean, you really just want to call it the Third World War or just the continuation of a world conflict over resources that began in 1914 with the World War I, that it was won broadly by Western capitalism.
Yeah, yeah. And what's so brilliant about that book too is the making the connections. I mean, we all knew for years that the overthrow of Allende was called Operation Jakarta, but that he actually went out and did the groundwork and showed those connections and that, you know, the graffiti campaign of Jakarta in Chile and also I think in Brazil and elsewhere.
Yes.
I mean, it makes you rethink. I mean, there's so much literature on international communism and not that much on international anti-communism.
Yep, absolutely. And the funny thing is that America pretty much gave the game away because, you know, the drumbeat of the Cold War was that we were fighting an international communist conspiracy. And the fact is we were not. I mean, China fell to communism, but within 20 years, Russia and China were enemies. Yeah. And there's an argument to be made that Russia and China came closer to having a nuclear war with one another at the height of their conflict of the 60s than the Russia and the United States ever did. And the Soviet intervention in third world anti-colonial struggles was spotty and haphazard and by the 70s, China was so pissed at the Soviet Union that they were one of, for example, the first governments to recognize Pinochet in Chile and mm-hmm. to fund our like apartheid backed psychos in Africa. I mean, there had been an international communist conspiracy. What there was an international capitalist conspiracy, which was manifested in things like Gladio and Operation Condor. And I mean, the economic architecture of the Bretton Woods system that emerged after World War II. That was in boardrooms and CIA safe houses and barracks across the world, a conspiracy to marketize the produce, the surplus of the world's resources.
Yeah. Yeah. And with that China, Sino-Soviet split, I mean, the poorly understood third Indochina War, where Cambodia gets turned into a proxy war between the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China.
Yeah,
communist states fighting amongst each other. China invades Vietnam.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, China. Who remembers and
all,
China
all,
they,
all this? Vietnam. Sort of forgot about. Like, oh, that was odd. But moving on, you know.
And by the way, Vietnam also kicked their ass.
Yeah, you know, I lived in Vietnam in the 90s and went up to. to Sapa and that region, and you can still see signs there. And also, the locals were very proud of that. And but the the Third Indochina War and the war amongst these communist states, I mean, that inspired Benedict Anderson to write Imagined Communities, mm-hmm. To make sense of this bizarre turn in what Cold War thinking had told us was going to happen. And then, you know, the absolute insanity that because things turn into a proxy war, the United States then becomes a patron of the Khmer Rouge.
And the United States that's my China favorite thing about
keep
it.
The Khmer that's my Rouge favorite going thing through the 1980s. I mean,
yep. Thatcher and Reagan airdropping machine guns and stuff into Pol Pot and arguing that they should be Cambodia's UN representative. Just too perfect.
I mean, it's difficult to teach this stuff to my undergraduates because they don't believe me. They're like, come on.
Yep. Yeah.
come on, Dr. Van, that didn't really happen.
Yeah.
Well, hey, man, absolute pleasure to talk to you. But two more questions before I let you go. Can you suggest two books on anything? Two books that are really important to you that you'd urge the audience to read?
Oh man. I just finished Cloud Splitter by Russell Banks, which is a novel about, it's a novel from the point of view of Owen Brown, John Brown's son, the one who survived. I think it's a great book to read for the moment to understand, more than anything, to understand the necessary role of a spirituality in political understanding and activism that I think is largely absent because, as I have said, people are communicating and creating politics in a space devoid of the connotative meaning that comes from emotion and emotional experience, mm-hmm. and that needs to be resurrected.
Okay, so that's Cloud Splitter by...
Cloud Splitter, yeah.
By who?
And I mentioned this, and I've said this on my stream before, and I love it just because it's so unlike every other broad history that I have seen. And is in that Wallenstein world systems tradition, Walter Scheidel's Escape from Rome, mm-hmm. simply because it is an attempt to do not Marxist, but materialist history in a way that is very difficult to find, because outside of the Marxist tradition, it seems as though there is like a historical allergy to a materialist reading. There's this terror of feeling like you are being deterministic. Like that's the word mm-hmm. that everyone wants to avoid having applied to their work. But what Scheidel does is he doesn't care. And that's very invigorating because in my mind, I'm sorry, at some point something has to determine things, right? Or they don't happen. And mm-hmm. Scheidel, I mean, and the broader materialist tradition I don't think that there's anything necessarily incompatible between Scheidel's analysis of the rise of capitalism in Europe and a Marxist one. I would say the only main difference is just one of perspectives. I think that Scheidel is broadly he's broadly pro-capitalist and sees it as like this explosion of efficiency and productivity that like rises people out. And the thing is, it was that at the time. And the further questions of what comes next are separate from any, you know, specific value judgment you might put on the process. But his fundamental willingness to take, you know, geographic considerations into account for the creation of broad historical social trends is great. And, okay.
And that's Escape from Rome. I'm sorry. Escape from Rome. Okay. And what are you working on now? Anything we can hope to see from you next? Anything in print?
Not in print right now, but I've got a couple of things that I'm hoping to start writing in the next month or two, a couple of articles. And then I want to take a lot of the stuff that I've been putting in a number of the streams I've been doing on Twitch, specifically since the election, and turn it into some sort of short volume that is like will be my hope, my contribution to sort of the what next question that a lot of people are asking now about you know the American political trajectory, not necessarily what will happen, but what needs to happen before anything can happen, basically. And then longer term, something. I want to do something, and I don't know what the form will be yet, but something with the question of what if Lincoln didn't die?
He would have been a vampire hunter. So that's what I know. Okay. Hey, Matt Crispin, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So this has been a conversation with Matt Crispin about his co-authored book, The Chapo Guide to Revolution, a manifesto against logic, facts, and reason, published with Simon & Schuster in 2018. I'm Michael Vann of Sacramento State University. Thank you for listening.